With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? It's estimated over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com today.
The Book of Job podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello again and welcome to the Book of Job podcast. I am Tom Verducci. I am here as always with Joe Madden. We like to call this the most interesting baseball podcast on the planet. And we're going to make a little bit of a detour right now to talk about football. And Joe Madden's favorite quarterback in the league right now, Brock Purdy. His dad obviously pitched for Joe Madden in the minor leagues in the Angels system.
That's right.
And Brock Purdy, Joe, keeps doing Brock Purdy things. The guy picked last in the National Football League draft is taking the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl. This is now 2 weeks in a row where Brock Purdy, it looked like a pitcher who didn't have his A game on the mound, somehow found it late in the game, 2 weeks in a row. If you look at his win over Green Bay, Joe, and now this win on Sunday against Detroit, in those critical moments with his team down, he completed 19 out of 23 passes for 284 yards, and he is now 21-5 as a starting quarterback in the NFL. Joe, you've seen it with some baseball pitchers who maybe don't grade out on the analytics numbers with over-the-top stuff, but some guys just know how to win, huh?
That's it. That sums it all up. That's well done. Yeah, he it's makeup, brother. It's makeup. It's the competitive nature. Of course he has talent. I mean, people will speak about him as though he's void of talent, that he can't throw or whatever. You watch. He made some nice throws yesterday in some tight windows. Early on, he was not. He was off. He looked like he might have been a little bit quick. His confidence wasn't quite there yet, or that rhythm was not there yet. But eventually, they showed one tight shot of him talking to Shanahan on the sidelines, and I thought, Shanahan looked like he was to the side of his mouth saying something a little bit more stern than normal. And you could see Brock listening, took it. I got it. Mm. And then eventually he comes out in the second half and does what he normally does. It was beautiful. I love that. And you're right. You're putting together a team, a baseball team or a football team, whatever. At some point, I think you have to almost begin with, what are we looking for here? Makeup. Competitive nature, accountability. These are the kind of things that he just drips with all those intangibles. And I think that's it. I mean, he only got drafted when he got drafted because they recognized that within him. They probably talked to somebody as coach, whatever, whomever, and this kid's got great intangibles. He competes. He never quits. The guys rally around him. That's probably why he got drafted. And of course, you know, his arm's definitely good enough. And then here comes the biggest stage. Last year, he kind of walked in there without any expectations and kind of nailed it. This year, a little bit more expectations. And so there might have been those moments when it was a little bit quicker, a little bit fuzzier, but eventually was able to slow it down and get it done. So that's what I see. And they went in, deep breath. Okay, we got this. Like you said, make a few adjustments. Whereas the other team, I thought Detroit was like, looked up and all of a sudden like, wow, look where we're at. One bad break, and all of a sudden it got fast, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and listen, you know his dad well. There was a great shot there of his dad in the stands after, you know, Brock made a couple of great plays with his feet there. A couple of times even put his shoulder down. He wasn't going into the slide mode. You could see him competing in the tightest moments of the game, going for every yard that he could. And his dad at one point got up in one of the, after one of those runs, and you could read the lips, and you heard the attaboy right there. Joe, our listeners can go back and listen to our podcast with Brock Purdy's dad. Give us an idea of what he was like as a competitor and a pitcher for you.
I just described him when I was talking about his kid, right? That's how he was. You know, he wasn't the most gifted by any means, but he wasn't like a tall right-hander like you're always looking for. Not a perfect body either, but really focused. He's the kind of guy when you had a conversation with him, looked you right in the eyeballs, had like this really deep, focused look about him, heard everything you said, highly respectful, and was obviously always looking for an edge, always looking to get better. So when he pitched, he kept getting better. And he never made it to the big leagues, right? We got through AAA, I think, with the Giants. Isn't that right?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. And then he kind of started closing games there because his makeup was so good. But if you're going to go out there as a scout with the gun and watch this and put the gun behind home plate and see, well, what's he doing? You're not going to be blown away by anything that he's doing. Nothing, except when you take it in its entirety. The guy was just so competitive and wanted to win and cared so much. And again, full of respect and accountability. So, okay, you talk about Sean, you talk about his kid, Brock, same dudes.
Yeah, that's awesome. And obviously, as you mentioned, the 49ers saw something in him. It did take a while to get drafted. They weren't jumping out on him early, but they saw something there. And give credit to that coaching staff, too, because one of the great things I like about Brock is, you know, he played a lot in college. He had a lot of reps under his belt in a lot of different circumstances. So playing that position, there's nothing like the experience of reps under center from the snap. So give them credit for sticking with a guy. Again, he doesn't have anything, I would say, Joe, that grades out physically as extraordinary. He does a lot of things well, but you know, arm strength, size, speed, those kinds of things, nothing is going to wow you. So give credit to that staff, because if you've paid attention a little bit to the NFL, Joe, you've seen that the same thing that has happened in baseball is happening in the NFL, where teams are putting more faith in analytics departments. And they're growing in size, and each one comes with their own agenda and their own kind of information, and they're feeding that to the coaching staffs. And now the coaching staffs are put in a position where they know the analytics group, you know, that's all coming from upstairs. So to deny what they're bringing to you is to deny your bosses, essentially. So there's a little push and pull going on there that we've seen happen in baseball, and I think that's why you see people like, you know, Mike Vrabel getting fired, that Bill Belichick can't get a job despite his resume, because to bring in a big Bill Belichick, you essentially have to, you know, reform or repurpose your analytics department, because they're not going to have the same sway with a guy like Bill Belichick. Because a lot of people just don't want to undo what's put in place with the analytics department and hire a coach who's going to have the larger say when it comes to whether it's personnel or planning. So a lot of similarities there as information grows around the game and these groups grow larger and larger. That's why, to circle back to Brock Purdy, I give Shanahan, the 49ers staff, credit for sticking with guy and seeing that there was something in the way this guy can run a game, especially in a tight spot. I don't know how you measure that, but coaches know it when they see it.
Yeah, what you're talking about there, obviously, too, it happens in baseball, football, whatever. The deeper the draft gets, more than likely the less tools that the player probably has. And that's where you got to really dig into the makeup. Now, I think the deeper a draft gets, you're still going to have a guy out there with like maybe one big tool, maybe two. So you're going to go after that and bet on that might surface. And eventually you can fill in the blanks with the other parts of his game that may need some more work. So again, like we're talking about Brock, you just can't discount the fact, yeah, he could throw the football and he throws well on the run and he moves and he got great vision and all this other stuff. So those are the things that probably got him drafted or why they stayed with him. And I got to believe just the conversation with them had to be very, very impactful. Next point on the analytical component, infiltrating football. Now, Campbell gets a lot of credit for having a lot of boldness with what he does. And I agree. I would have played for this guy in a heartbeat. But I also believe going for it on fourth down like he has, as often as he has been encouraged by the people that works within his analytical department. So it's easier for him to make that decision. And then when it doesn't go well, he's okay because he's going to be supported with that. I've talked about this before, and the best way I could describe it, and I do believe it to be true, that analytics provides a safety net for decision making. In other words, when you are basing a decision completely and entirely on analytics and it doesn't go well, everybody's okay with that because it's been supported by all the group upstairs, all the guys we fired, this vast number of analysts that says it's wise, or it's, you know, let's do it on this particular situation. It's a good bet. Let's do it, et cetera. And if it doesn't work out, just keep doing it, because eventually it's going to. That's where the safety net is provided. So coaches that are fully bought into analytical departments can make decisions somewhat more freely or easily because they are being supported in that regard. Now, if there's not so much analytics involved, if there is analytics involved, and say the coach kind of goes rogue on analytics and makes decisions based on, even he'll admit after the game, was something I felt, something I thought about in the past, something that's worked for me before. And if he provides that kind of an explanation, that does not play well with the way front offices and information is gathered today. So therein lies the rub. So when you get an aggressive coach that takes chances in an NFL football game or collegiately, whatever, just know that he is being highly supported by his department upstairs, which then permits him to make this decision more freely. Because if it's not right, it's cool. But when you make decisions like a Belichick or a Vrabel or the other guys that may have be looking for a job right now, and it doesn't go right, then it's really frowned upon. And you need to start listening more, you know, play the dots defensively. Wherever I tell you to play your shortstop, play him on this count because that's what the dots say. That's what it's really devolved into. So just trying to give an overarching view on all this, that's what's going on. You got a player and a scouting department that takes a chance on Brock Purdy for all these human reasons. And then you get a guy like Campbell taking chances. That might be part of his personality. It appears to be. But when you're supported by front office analytical departments, it's easier to make a decision like that and be wrong and be good with it.
Joe, I like the way you put that, calling it a safety net when you have the numbers behind you. And that certainly, I think, leads to the widespread adoptions to some of the things we're seeing. For instance, in the NFL, it has become, I would say, routine now that on fourth and two or less, depending on where you are on the field, I would say midfield in, teams are going to go for it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not surprised. And now we have, I love this graphic, the TV networks will throw up there on fourth down. They'll say, the analytics say, and they'll be in green, go for it. Like it's coming from the voice of God. Like that's the absolute right decision. When we all know analytics is based on huge sample sizes, right? Your playing percentages is exactly what you're doing. To me, I thought Campbell got a little bit more of a pass on going for it because, as you said, that's part of his personality. They do play a very aggressive game. It dovetails with the analytics. But I think given that particular situation, you have to make the best call, the best decision in terms of those elements that are in play at that point, not the large sample size. I think on the road, you got to tie that game. And I realized that field goal was not automatic, 40-something yards. I get it. I thought right away, you've got to go for the tie. Put the points on the board. Don't turn the ball over if you don't get this first down. Mm-hmm. I thought specific to that situation, going for it was the right thing to do. But I don't like the idea that just because, quote unquote, analytics say it's the right thing to do, then you get a pass. Because that takes all thinking out of the equation, Joe.
Absolutely. And again, it's happened in our sport also where it'll be said, well, he's been doing it that way all year, right? Been doing it that way all year. Thus, it's okay to do it again. And then not have it work out. That's exactly what had happened. And it's, like I said, it's easier to accept when it doesn't work because of that reason. I'm pretty certain I heard after the game, I think it was Jim Nance that said he was curious to see how analytics would like frame this game or the different kind of components or what was going to be said analytically after this game. He was curious to hear that breakdown. And I thought that was really curious. So a guy of his ilk and all the years that he's been doing this, all of a sudden, he wants to hear the analytical breakdown of the game. And I found that curious because it's becoming to the point now where it's like everything else. Even the media has bought into this so much, the analytical component, that they're really kind of almost recommending it or putting it forward or right out front because they, I don't know if they really consider it that important or they're just playing along. That's what I'm having a hard time understanding.
Yeah, it's the easy thing to do. You know, you put your faith in the numbers, and we all think mathematics can't be wrong, but, right, you know, analytics have to choose numbers to put into the equation and actually have to put a formula together. Who does that? Well, the analytics people do that.
That's right.
And that reminds me, Joe, and I'll give a little bit of a spoiler alert here. You and Terry Francona sat with me and Bob Costas recently to look at and review Game 7 of the 2016 World Series. And by the way, thanks for doing that. It was awesome. When that airs, people, you really have to watch that. A deep dive into the greatest game that I have seen in my 40-some-odd years covering Major League Baseball. And just so many twists and turns. And one of them, this conversation brought me back to it, Joe, was when Terry Francona bunted early in that game with his number 9 hitter, Roberto Perez. He's trailing in Game 7 of the World Series, and I went back and I checked, and he had not bunted with a position player trailing in a game before the 7th inning. And I think this was the 3rd inning in Game 7 of the World Series. So it's something he had not done all year long, and he's essentially playing for one run when he's down one. And obviously I asked Terry about his thinking, and it had nothing to do with analytics, of course. It was about the flow of the game. Actually, I think he was down more than one. I think it was multiple runs at that point. He might have been up 3, Joe. But he felt like to get his team back into the game, he wanted a point on the board. He also pointed out that his usual starting catcher, the better offensive hitter, Yan Gomes, was not in the lineup. This is his number 9 hitter, backup catcher, Roberto Perez. And just the flow of the game told Terry Francona, who has seen thousands of games in his major league playing and managing career, told him this is the right time to play for one run. If you went strictly by an analytics chart, you would never do that. And I thought that was a great window into what a veteran baseball manager processes at the time, rather than looking at a chart and saying analytics say don't bunt. He did essentially what his experience told him to do.
He wanted the runner at third base with the next hitter coming up. Perez was the hitter, and obviously on is great catcher, but not that good with the bat. He definitely wanted that runner move 90 feet to facilitate him scoring, which he did following that bunting him up to third base. So, yeah, that's the whole point. Every situation is different. You cannot manage every situation identically. The scoreboard, the outs, the hitter, how's he doing? Who's on deck? Who's in the hole? How's this pitcher throwing? What are they willing to do? Are they going to play the infield in and play the infield back? I mean, there's so many different things to consider. And the analytical component just treats everything the same. It's a cookie cutter to a number, to analytically speaking, whereas it's not. It's this human element that has so many variables, nuances, layers, textures to it that has to be considered in a nanosecond. And that's the best way I could describe it. And that's why Tito did what he did. And respectfully, I mean, of course, you know, we'll take the out right there. But nevertheless, he got what he wanted too. And what he had spoken about, I'd already brought it up in that conversation, is that our big thing was to score first, which we did first at bat, Dexter dead center. But all of those things are being thought of. And it's not, you just can't put in this big bucket of analytics and feel and believe as though it's going to fit all sizes, all moments, all textures, all situations.
So for you as a fan, when you're watching these games at home and you see that analytics says go for it or punt or whatever it says, keep in mind that's just a rule of thumb. That's what the overall largest sample size, the larger percentage will tell you is the quote-unquote right thing to do. But it does not weigh in the specific personnel, the weather, the momentum of the game, the, you know, all of those things that are difficult to quantify are not formulated in there. So when you see those numbers, what the analytics suggests, think of it as, yeah, that's probably, you know, the likely thing to do, but it does not address the actual situation at hand. Hey, a lot more baseball to talk about here. I know we started with football, but obviously we got into some parallels there. How about this? Would you give a player who never played a day in the major leagues almost $30 million? Well, one team did, and we'll talk about that.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BookofJoe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BookofJoe.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Joe, you might have caught the news. The Detroit Tigers signed young second baseman Colt Keith. He's 22 years old, to a six-year contract that guarantees him $28.6 million. They also get three option years. So they essentially bought out his first 3 years of free agency besides all of his arbitration years and his first 6 years of control. Colt Keith is someone who's going to compete for the starting second base job for the Tigers. He is, I think, probably more naturally a third baseman. But if you want to comp to this young man, the best one I came up with was Jason Kipnis. He's a bat-first second baseman who's got a really advanced approach at the plate. He's got pop. He's going to be a good offensive player. He's going to be, I'd say, adequate defensively and with the opportunity to get better. He's a good athlete. He's a big guy. 6'2", 6'3", about 220, strong guy. But, Joe, I love this signing for Detroit. First of all, based on where they are in the winning curve there, this team is coming on. They've got a good core of young players. It's a great message that you believe in your players. You're not going to do this with everybody. You're going to do this with someone you feel confident about. A, is going to be an everyday player in the big leagues. And B, he's got the kind of work ethic and makeup that you can trust him, that his motivation, his desire, his all that work ethic is not going to change now that you've given him security. What's in it for the Tigers? They save a lot of money. I'll give you an example. My comp to him right now in the big leagues is Gleyber Torres. Bat first, second baseman, good player. He's made the All-Star team twice. In his first 6 years, he's going to make about $38 million. So the Tigers are saving money. They're saving $10 to $12 million, and you also factor in the free agent years. Torres' free agent years are valued between, I don't know, $15 and $20 million. They're getting this kid at $13 million free agent years. So that's what you get when you get security. You give up maximum value that you can earn by going year in, year out. So, Joe, we don't see this often. He's the seventh player to get a contract without having played a big leagues that is extended for this long. Give me your thoughts as a guy, and I'm going to ask you to put your scouting hat back on. When you've got a young player, 22 years old, he's done well in the minor leagues, and you're projecting out what he can do in the big leagues, you're betting this guy's going to make it, not just be a contributor, but an everyday player. So give me your thoughts on giving that kind of security to a young player.
You got to be certain, man. And I guess there are certain players that you're going to feel that strongly about. I'd have to be convinced about his makeup and his accountability and that I'm not going to see anybody different over the next couple of years. Because I could go back to the minor leagues. We've talked about this. I had Mark McLemore, and I'm just going to use Fluffs as an example. And, you know, he's wonderful. We're great friends. But he was doing really well as a 19-year-old with the Angels coming up through the minor leagues. Gets hurt. We sent him to Anaheim for a couple of weeks to rehab. He comes back to Midland, and all of a sudden I get a different guy. You know, all of a sudden things had changed. He wasn't the same cat. And things kind of went different regarding, his work ethic and how he thought about himself and the motivation, et cetera. It just was departed a bit, right? So I've always had that in the back of my mind. But things have changed, times have changed, and I don't know this kid, but I'm always a little bit concerned. I'd have to be like really convinced solidly that this is who this guy is. I'm not going to see anybody different after a little bit of success. I've got to be guaranteed of his work ethic, which I'm sure they are. I know Scotty Harris really well with the Tigers, and I could absolutely see that AJ, these guys are really good. So I would have to be convinced on that. I think, when it comes down to his abilities, his tools, that would be obvious. Okay, yeah, he's got a great swing. He shows you he's got great plate discipline. He's got the power potential that I'm looking for. He knows what to do with two strikes. He knows how to make adjustments during the at-bat, all that stuff. Now, defensively, I hear what you're saying there, and I would have to believe just through repetition and again, with getting some good information from a good infield coach, that's going to naturally just improve. I don't even know what his arm looks like. So it would just be so much of that to me is about his makeup and how I perceive his personality to be. And if that was firm, because that's the harder part to ascertain. The easier part, again, is the tools. The tools will be obvious. And if I could be convinced that he matches up on the mental tools, I would be all in on that.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And also, like you, I put a lot of trust in the Scotty Harris and AJ Hinch to make that decision. I mean, this kid's been in their minor league system for, 3 or 4 years. They know the player well. They know his work ethic. You don't make this blindly just on talent alone, this kind of commitment. So I'm with you. And in this case, I will trust that the team knows the player better than all of us do. And they wouldn't be reaching out like this unless they were convinced that he's the right guy to make this decision on. Mm-hmm. As far as the talent goes, he's played 239 games in the minors, and I guess the minors, but this is what we have to go by. His slash line is 300, 382, 512. That's pretty impressive. I mean, that's an OPS of 894. The swing and miss, the strikeout percentage is about average. It's not poor. It's not exceptional as far as putting the ball in play. It's about average, not bad, but an 894 OPS. Compare that to, I mentioned Gleyber Torres. Torres was 784 in the minor leagues. Nolan Gorman, another guy you can compare him to at the Cardinals, who's a big swing and miss guy with a little more power, 834 OPS. That's below what Keith has put up. And actually, Keith's slugging percentage is higher. And I mentioned Jason Kipnis, 863 OPS. It's very comparable to what Keith has put up. So the numbers are there that this guy's going to produce in the big leagues. Now, if you're a naysayer, you're going to say, well, wait a second. Remember when the Phillies signed Scott Kingery, 6 years, $24 million? Hey, remember when the Mariners signed Evan White, the first baseman, 6 years, $24 million? How'd those work out? And going back a little farther, John Singleton with the Astros got $10 million for 5 years. It was a bust. Here's my take on those, Joe. It does happen. You overvaluate your own players. First of all, these guys haven't put up the kind of production that Keith has in the minor leagues. But also, even if you're wrong for a club, $24 million over 6 years is not going to break your franchise. To me, it's the whole risk-reward here, Joe, that you can make this investment in a young player, you can give him security, you can believe in the player, and if it doesn't work out, it's not preventing you from doing other things. I think the ability to give the player security, he doesn't have to worry about his service time clock. He doesn't have to worry about his value on a year-to-year basis. Just go out there and play. The message you send to your other minor league players that we take care of our own, I think that's all worth the quote-unquote risk of handing out $24 million over 6 years.
The two of those gentlemen you talked about, White, and is it Singleton or Singletary with the Houston?
Singleton, yeah. John Singleton?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both first basemen, these guys just absolutely have to hit to be successful.
Right.
And you're gonna pay for the bat. I mean, they're not going to give – Detroit's not going to give the kid that much money if they did not think he was going to hit. You're paying – in today's game, you're paying for the bat first. They're not going to pay because he's going to be a great defensive second baseman. So that's always the risk there. And again, never having seen him swing. Now, Singleton, man, when he first showed up, boy, that was good. And White to me was a wizard with the glove, and he was playing first base. He was a great gloveman. I mean, he made plays against us all year that was unreal. So there's all of these things to consider. And again, at the end of the day, you brought it up. To me, the most important factor there is knowing the guy and your player and all the coaches that have come in contact with him. And, Ryan Garko is he had been in charge of the minor league system, and Gark's pretty good at this stuff too. So all these evaluations are there. Everybody's on board. And when everybody's on board like that, it's so much easier to go ahead and make a decision like this. And you said something there that I think is really important. The example that it sets for the rest of the group, the other young Detroit players coming on up, and in the future, the loyalty that you may be able to purchase by doing something like that. I wrote a paper in 1980-something about something like that where ownership, I thought, should pay more attention to minor league players and actually go out and see minor league teams during the course of a season in order to buy some kind of loyalty, potentially. It might be impossible anymore, but I like the kid that matters too. If a kid that recognizes, hey, these guys had this kind of trust in me, the owner showed up in some A-ball town in the middle of June 1 year, and he came out and talked to all of us, and he came up to me specifically. Doesn't that have some kind of cachet eventually? Or is it just totally about money and the way the thing is constructed now? But that matters. I want to believe that matters, that this kid's got to feel the loyalty and the confidence that they have in him. At some point, that's got to pay off.
Yeah, I agree with you. And by the way, you're right. Evan White's defensive skills are tremendous. But at first base, man, you got to bring the stick.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how well you can pick it over there.
Correct.
And it's a great point I think, Joe, especially for Detroit, I mean, 7 straight losing seasons. They had a really nice finish to the year last year. And they're, to me, a dark horse candidate to actually win the American League Central this year. I think that highly of what Scotty Harris and A.J. Hinch are doing there. They've got a good, really good core of young players now. When you think about, Keith, we just mentioned him, Jace Young, Josh Young's brother, is probably going to be in the big leagues this year. Another infielder, hits left-handed. You got, of course, Riley Green, the former number one pick. You got Carpenter. You've got Parker Meadows. They've got this core, Joe, of young left-handed position players who are either ready right now or just on the doorstep of being ready. And it really reminds me a lot of what Arizona and Baltimore have done in the last couple of years. When you look at how those teams turned it around, made it in the postseason last year, each of them, Arizona to the World Series, they were loaded with good, young, left-handed hitters. And if you want to have an imbalance on your team, I've always thought it's much better to have more lefties than righties, just because of the preponderance of right-handed pitching. And I kind of like what Detroit is building here. It would not surprise me if they're on this really quick trajectory now to get into postseason play, if not this year, then next year.
And sometimes winning within a city is contagious, right?
That's right.
Right across the street from Comerica is Ford Field, where the Lions play, and then you got the Tigers right across the street.
Hey, Michigan did pretty well this year in college football.
Yeah, Michigan wasn't that bad. You're right. How about the hockey team? I don't even know what's going on with the Red Wings. But sometimes that happens. Cities catch on fire athletically with their sports teams, and all of a sudden it becomes a contagion. I mean, that's what you're talking about the Tigers, and I'm thinking about Lions right there, and I'm thinking exactly, how they got to where they've gotten to so quickly. And there is that epiphany, that moment. It's almost like the point where Detroit might struggle a bit early in the season next year, but by the middle and end of that season, they should pretty much get their act together based on all these players you're talking about. They have been through their struggles somewhat. They know who they are right now. They know their identity, their personal philosophy, and you'd like to believe that at some point it's going to take root. So that's – I'm always aware of that. I always look at that stuff. Baltimore Orioles this year, Baltimore Ravens, of course. Too bad the Baltimore Bullets still aren't there in that little arena downtown Baltimore. But all this stuff, somehow, it happens. It just happens that way.
Yeah, it reminds me back in 1969 with the Mets, the Jets, and the Knicks.
That's right.
Going back a ways for that,
right?
Ancient history. But it happens.
Against Bullets, Colts, and the, what sport am I missing?
Orioles.
Here? The Orioles, right. They beat them in all three.
Yeah. Probably their young listeners are like, who? Bullets? Who are the Bullets?
The Baltimore, Earl the Pearl Monroe folks.
Yeah, Wes Unseld.
Bobby Danridge, Jack Maron, that was good stuff. Really good stuff.
Hey, that reminds me of the Orioles. We talked about the Orioles with the way they've come on. Your buddy Brandon Hyde taking them to the best record of the American League last year. Hadn't been swept all regular season, and that's how they went out in the postseason to Texas. But, Joe, I look at that team, and you talk about locking guys up. First of all, let me ask you this. It's a quick question. Locking up a position player at that age, you probably just can't do it, right? Because of the injury factor. Talking about pitcher rather than a position player.
Yeah, with a pitcher, it's tough. It is tough. It's a lot easier to open up your checkbook if the pay to the order two is with their position player over a pitcher, yes.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, so I look at the Baltimore Orioles, and to me, they have potentially, if not right now, four franchise players. Mm-hmm. Grayson Rodriguez, he's got a great arm. Yeah. Personally, I'm a little concerned about his mechanics, but this kid has got terrific stuff, really good makeup, had a really breakout year last year, especially in the second half of the season. Of course, you've got Adley Rutschman behind the plate. You've got Gunnar Henderson, the rookie of the year, and now you have Jackson Holliday coming on. So Brandon's got a nice problem to have. He probably pushes Gunnar to third and Holliday at short in a perfect world, but both are great athletes, can go back and forth if they have to. You know, my question is, you've heard the Baltimore Orioles. You got the foundations here for these guys to play together for a long time. Mm-hmm. And with position players, let's take Grayson out of the equation for a minute. With position players, these guys are so good, Joe. And in the cases of Rutschman and Henderson, you've seen it on the big league level. Man, don't go year to year with these guys. You know, make sure your fans can buy a jersey one of these guys and realize he's not going to wind up playing for the Yankees or the Dodgers, but he's going to be the next Cal Ripken. Commit to these guys. Send that message that we talked about to the rest of the people, not just on the major league team, but on the minor league teams, that you take care of your own, that you're building something long term. I think this is a real opportunity for the Orioles, who, let's face it, they don't go out there and sign big free agents. They just don't. They don't make long-term commitments. This is an opportunity now to believe in the right guys, because I think they have the right guys there. I wouldn't worry about giving extensions to any of those guys.
Yeah, I went through the same thing with the Cubbies too, right? I mean, you know, we win a World Series actually, and we still had a possibly, what, the youngest team that ever won the World Series, average age-wise. But then again, that group was not kept together. So I don't even know, like, when it comes to the evaluations of front offices and how they look at things like this, that would be a better question for them to answer than for me. Because that group then, the Cubs, we thought that group was going to be together for a long, long time. And then, of course, it was not.
Well, I know this, Joe. I know that Theo made efforts to get every one of those guys locked up. We were talking Baez, right. Rizzo, Bryant, Schwarber. They could never get it done. Right. And in some cases, if not all of them, they didn't do so well on the open market once they got there.
Afterwards.
Yeah, right. I mean, everybody thinks the grass is always greener, but it's not because Theo and that crew did not want to keep those guys around. It just never worked out. And you're right. Those are the type of players you do want to lock up.
Well, that's my point. I mean, is okay, the Cubs weren't able to lock these guys up for a variety of different reasons. The Oriole players that you've just described, are they going to be any different? Do they want to be locked up? Do they want to spread their wings eventually? How does that all play out in the long term? Because, I mean, when I was there with the Cubbies, I mean, everybody's talking about this as a dynastic situation. And of course, it never turned out to be that. So we're looking at the Orioles almost through the same lens that we looked at the Cubs at that particular time. And eventually, like you said, these guys went different places with the varied degrees of success. So, I get it. I understand it. But again, I'm always in the back of my mind, for as much as I see a young player and think he will never change, sometimes they do. So I'd have to be boots on the ground, inside the doors, in the clubhouse, talking to these guys to give you a better opinion on that, because I have seen guys change that you thought would never change.
It happens. They're human beings. And the other thing I'll add to that, Joe, is that because a player is good at a young age, and I hear this all the time, and it's just not true. People will say, well, he's going to get better.
Right.
You know, what happens when he gets better? It just does not work that way, folks. Sometimes you're at your peak at a young age. I remember when Dwight Gooden set the world on fire at 19 and 20 years old in 1984, 1985. You know, and people were saying, my goodness, what is this guy going to be when he gets experience under his belt and he's 27, 28, the typical prime of a career? And it was the late, great Bob Gibson who said, you know what? This may be as good as he ever is. You never know. It's hard to be better than Dwight Gooden was in 1985, first of all. And it was true. I mean, he had this youthfulness, this suppleness to his delivery. The ball just exploded out of his hand. Everything lined up at the right time. Of course, he had some other problems, issues off the field later on. But don't fall into the trap, people, of thinking just because a guy is good at 21 and 22, my goodness, I can't wait till he's 28, 29. He's going to be even better. It is not a linear growth path in Major League Baseball.
And conversely, the guy that has not shown so well early on, I don't know how many times I've had the conversation within meetings that sometimes you're the lucky team to be the second or even the third team to get a particular player. And the classic example for me was always Carlos Pena with the Rays when we got him. He had been with the Oakland A's and the Detroit Tigers to that point. And I remember the offseason, Andrew and I are talking. I'm in Brea, California, probably just got off a bike ride. We're talking about Carlos Pena. I love Carlos Pena. I just saw him pretty much annihilate some baseballs. Great first baseman, but it never really took root for him. Okay. That happens. And what happens, I think, is that guys that are kind of that ilk, when they're younger, there might be high expectations. They come out with a lot of fanfare and they just never settle in. Their minds never really settle down. They're not able to breathe and see like they had done in high school or college, but eventually they do. And sometimes they got to get away from that original parent and get out of the house and go to high school and then go to college. And all of a sudden you see that everything differently and everything kind of slows down. And now all those abilities, all that talent that everybody has spoken about that you definitely have had, now it comes to the forefront because you're just able to think differently. You see things differently. So sometimes the dude that was supposed to be the prodigy and is not, just give him a little time and maybe in a team or two later, this guy's going to be everything you thought he was going to be.
We've talked a lot about locking players up and growth patterns of players as they develop. I want to ask Joe about his take on one of the biggest free agents that's still out there. Why has he not signed? And in my opinion, why has he not re-signed? We'll talk about Cody Bellinger right after this.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Joe, we talked about locking players up and finding the right spots and believing in someone's talents. Cody Bellinger is a sort of a mystery as to why he has not been signed yet after a great bounce back season last year. It looked like he was lost as far as a hitter the last couple of years with the LA Dodgers. He had a terrific season last year with the Chicago Cubs. Cody Bellinger last year had the second highest batting average with two strikes in Major League Baseball. Only Luis Arraez, who's just a magician with the bat, had a higher batting average. Cody Bellinger hit .279 with two strikes. That's the highest by an outfielder since Mookie Betts in 2018. Talking about two-strike hitting with Cody Bellinger, when did you ever talk about that? But I think it spoke, Joe, to the adjustments he made in the offseason. It wasn't like the Dodgers were trying to fix him, but as you know, sometimes you need a different voice. And he dove into his swing in the offseason at home in Arizona, made some really key adjustments in his setup. I think the whole key for me was he got his hands in a better position and he got into a ready position earlier. Cody is a guy who used to never move anything until the ball was literally coming out of the pitcher's hand. And you can do that when you have incredible bat speed, which he has, and quick twitch muscles. But just getting ready a little bit earlier, and then especially with two strikes, putting the ball in play and just taking a single when it was an order. That's what he did. So I love the adjustments that he made. I do think it's sustainable, but he's still out there as a free agent. I think because teams are having a hard time valuing what he is, Joe, in terms of a guy who's gone through some ups and downs in his career. But to circle back about extending people, I just think Cody found a really good place, both physically and mentally last year. As I said, he lives in Arizona. The Cubs trained there. He did a lot of work at the complex in the offseason last year. This, to me, Joe, is a marriage that somehow has to work out. Cody Bellinger going back to the Cubs. It still hasn't happened yet, so that puts some doubt in your mind. But I still think this is where it should and will wind up.
Had a couple of thoughts. Let me just see if I can, in no particular order, analytics has something to do with that. The fact that you just described his two-strike approach, which was outstanding and which I love, but analysts might look at that as being lucky. They'll view that as being more luck than actual talent. And so I think a lot of the analytical departments are kind of pushing back on such big numbers based on that. And they have a lot of jack when it comes to obviously the signing of somebody. So I think that's part of the landscape right now regarding why he has not been signed and why that number seems to be so high for that particular reason, number two.
Okay, let me dive into number one, because that's a great point.
Yep.
And you're right. If you looked at the numbers, you will see that in 2022 with two strikes on batting average on balls in play, when he did put the ball in play with two strikes, he hit only 264. And in 2023, that was all the way up to 386. Mm-hmm. And it kills me as you referred to this, Joe, when people will say he was lucky.
Yeah.
People look at a high average on batting average on balls in play and say, well, he was lucky. It's going to reverse next year. If you looked at the guy, how he played the game, he had a very different swing with two strikes in 2023. That was not luck. Did a couple of balls drop in? Well, yeah, of course they did. But more dropped in because he cut down on his swing. So just to look at a number and say you were lucky, that's just lazy.
Yeah, and it's almost generated on your desires or your like of the guy. In other words, if his number was really low, they would say that he was unlucky, that it's going to come back up, it's going to be high next year. But because it was so high, he was lucky, and of course he's got to regress to the mean.
I'm sorry I cut you off there, Joe, but the whole thing drives me nuts.
But it's exactly what's going on. I've heard that so many times, so I think that's why he's still available, number one. Number two, why he was better, watching him swing, different swing. I mean, he's not as big. He will get big on occasion, probably more than likely when he's ahead in the count. But I'm not seeing as much, you know, dipping with the back shoulder, just trying to lift the ball all the time, a much flatter approach into the zone and the ability to drive the ball probably to left center more consistently, or just that duck fart to left field. That's really wonderful with two strikes and runners in scoring position. So I think there is a physical difference for me compared to the year before, which would give me reason to believe that he can do it again. The other point with like these numbers and where he's going to end up, to me, part of the, I would think, trepidation in with the Cubbies is that to give him that big of a number, he's going to go back there and he will be the straw. He's the straw that's supposed to stir the drink. And I think that concerns them a little bit. I do. Whereas I think if he went to the Yankees, it's more, it's tastier because he's part of the group and he's going to get lost in this group. And there's more probability that he's going to play to the level that he did last year, whereas all of a sudden he's going to be the guy. And then furthermore, just giving him a lot of number, he was so motivated by not having done well, I got to reestablish myself. He goes out and works to the point where he does reestablish himself. So now if we give him a big number, is that going to change anything? So I'm just saying these are parts of the conversation that groups have to analyze, and then knowing the person, try to come to terms with what they believe and what they don't believe. So that's where it's at, I think, with him. For me, I understand what you say about the Cubs. I think the ballpark's good for him. But if you put him in a place like Yankee Stadium in center field where he becomes part of the group, I think you have your better chance of him reestablishing what he had done last year, as opposed to if you actually put him out front a little bit more, because last year he was a part of the group. Under these circumstances, he will be the guy.
Yeah, it's funny because I look at it completely differently.
Okay.
First of all, I believe the Yankees truly needed someone like Bellinger, like a guy who can legit play center field.
Correct.
I cannot believe they're going into the 2024 season thinking Aaron Judge is going to play center field four or five times a week. That's just madness for a guy with an injury history who's 6'8", 280 pounds. That's just crazy. I would never do that. But that's what they're planning on. That's why I thought when Grisham was included in the Soto trade, he would fill that role. But no, they're not talking like that. So Bellinger, yes, skill set. He's that guy. I think New York would be a disaster for him. I think he's a complimentary player. I don't think he would want the expectations walking into New York. It could be another Joey Gallo. And I love Joey Gallo, but he will be the first one to tell you he did not handle that environment well. So coming in as a free agent, you know, big number, big ticket, big name, into New York, that takes a certain guy, a certain mindset. That, to me, that's not Cody Bellinger. And I think returning to the place where he had success, the expectations are not as great. I mean, when you switch teams, the expectations, to me, ratchet up. And I think, you know, there's enough around him in Chicago that, yeah, he's probably going to be the highest paid player if he goes back there. Yeah, but I don't think he's the aircraft carrier that people would expect him to be in Chicago. I really don't. I think he is a complimentary player with a great skill set that earns him a lot of money because he's a fabulous base runner and defender, as well as a guy who's not the same power hitter he was back in 2019. He doesn't have to be because he's a better overall hitter. But I think the expectations would be a lot worse in New York than it would be in Chicago.
He's just a good baseball player. That's what you're describing right there. And again, it's almost like a left-handed KB, Chris Bryant. I mean, you describe the same kind of skill set, very athletic, able to play more than one position and do it really well. And then offensively, you get this up and down chart flow with these guys, both extremely talented, but you just don't know quite what to expect. Regarding New York, I don't have any idea if this plays or not, but I had his daddy, Clay, with the Angels for a bit. And Clay, of course, spent some time in New York. I don't even know if that would permit or allow him to understand that a little bit better, just having that kind of experience within the family. There's got to be a lot of conversations with that, et cetera. And again, I don't even know if there are any kind of offers going on there. But I understand what you're saying. But I say if you put him in a lineup with Judge and Soto and that particular group, and at that ballpark too is intriguing. I think he is a very good center fielder. And you're right. I mean, to play Aaron out there often, you're looking for problems with that. I really do believe that also. So, yeah, your logic is outstanding. I just think that in my mind's eye, you put him with that New York group, LeMahieu, Rizzo, all these guys. Rizzo will keep him straight. You know, Judge will keep him straight. And then you got Soto. It's going to all the spotlight's going to be him on him the whole time. I think he could actually just morph into there very easily.
Yeah, you know, and people will say, well, you know, what's so hard about New York? And I think I can put Philly and Boston in this same umbrella, Joe. It is different. The word I use is accountability, where there's hyper accountability. If you go 0-for-4 opening day, you've got a gaggle in front of your locker asking you what happened. You need to explain yourself. And if you don't explain yourself, that's even worse. That doesn't happen in other markets. It's the volume of the media covering. It's the fact that, you know, back pages need to be filled. Stories need to be written all the time. So you don't have the kind of literal breathing room you have in other environments. Not everybody is cut out for that. Juan Soto, I think, is going to be absolutely fine. I remember, you know, when the trade was made, the guy who signed him for the Nationals, Johnny DiPuglio, the scout, was there. And he told me, Juan Soto has wanted to play in New York since he was a kid. He's built for this. Those are the kind of guys you don't worry about. Cody Bellinger, living in Arizona, a little more definitely a laid-back kind of character that he is. I don't see him responding to that sort of energy and day-to-day accountability that you have to withstand in New York.
Last point. I mean, in Chicago, I mean, I felt a higher level of accountability in Chicago also.
Sure.
And I really, I think it's great. I mean, that's what I think sometimes it's misconstrued. Whereas when you have a highly accountable fan base and media, that really should bring out the best in you, I think.
Agreed.
To be in a more lazier setting where, you know, bad day, bad week, whatever, people aren't really getting on you nearly as badly or as much, it gets a little sleepy. So I'm telling you, man, I loved Chicago for that. The fact we had not won in 108 years and all of a sudden you do something like that. And even after you win, and then like you're saying, you just go through a bad moment, even after you win for the first time 108 and all of a sudden it's like, well, it's almost like you forgot everything you had done to get you there. You're not as good as what you had done before. Now it turns on you. It could turn on you rather quickly, but you go to the ballpark, man. That's why the 1:20 afternoon game in Chicago kind of works, because you're not tired. The moment you walk into Wrigley Field for a day game, it's 10 o'clock. I hated day games because I hated getting up that early. You got to talk to everybody. You got to be on from the first thing in the morning. But once you get used to it, it turns you on too, man. So there's something about the accountability of a fan base and a media that I think should bring out the best in an athlete.
It's a great point. The energy that comes with all the accountability is something that should work in a positive direction. Now, you just have to understand that you can't take things personally. And it was Greg mm-hmm. Jeffries. I don't know if you remember Greg Jeffries.
Mm-hmm. I had him.
Yeah. Okay. Greg Jeffries started obviously in New York, and he did really well, especially his first year there. But, you know, listen, there are times it happens to everybody. You go in a slump and New York doesn't care what you've already put in the bank. You know, they want to hit that next time up mm-hmm. and they'll get on you. Lots of great players. Derek Jeter has been booed in New York. That's not a surprise. Mm-hmm. But what Greg Jeffries said is then when he went to both St. Louis and Kansas City, he said it was startling, the difference, because when you were slumping there, they cheered harder for you. They thought of you as one of their own and wanted to pull you through by supporting you. Totally different, the way different fan bases react to it. So you just have to understand, I think, when you're playing in New York, Boston, Philly, that's going to happen. That they care so much about it that it's frustration that they're going to voice, and you try not to. You shouldn't take it so personally.
Trey Turner, right? Last year with the Philly fan base.
There you go. That was great.
They went bizarro Philly right there. They went the exact opposite. They went George Costanzonis. They did the exact opposite. And all of a sudden it worked for him. I get that. But I'm just here to say, man, worked in Anaheim, worked in Chicago, and of course worked in Tampa Bay. By far, the most electric feeling you have on a daily basis. The one that really wakes you up. The one that makes you really rely on everything you've learned at that particular moment is when you walk into Wrigley on a Monday afternoon. I've talked to you about this before. Monday afternoon, makeup game, Cleveland Indians, Kluber versus Lester, 40,000 people. Come on.
Yeah, and I've always said that's why those teams, to me, they have a little bit of an edge when it comes to postseason play mm-hmm. because they've played in hostile and energetic environments all the time. So just finishing up on Cody Bellinger, I do think mm-hmm. he will re-sign with the Cubs. I think that's his best place. We'll see what happens. It's no guarantee. But I just remember it was a couple of years ago now, a few years ago, showing up at Philly's spring training. Pitchers and catchers had already been there. I think the position players had showed up. And that's when Bryce Harper was signed. Remember, spring training yep. camps had opened up. Bryce Harper, coming off a 100 RBI season as a free agent, wasn't signed until camps had opened up. Of course, Bellinger and Harper both have the same agent, Scott Boras. So it's not a surprise that Scott Boras' clients are out there this late. It's just the way things go. Until he gets the number that he wants from the team that he wants, he'll continue to wait. It wouldn't surprise me if, like Bryce Harper, Cody Bellinger doesn't sign until the middle of February.
I had Dexter Fowler walk out onto the field.
That was great. I was there that
okay.
day.
So we've actually had that. I was given a heads up right before it had happened. And, of course, Dexter was so important to the success of that group during that period of time. Not given nearly the credit. I mean, I've never been around such a consistent personality through good or bad on a daily basis. Turned out to be a really good friend. But he was that important to the success of the Cubs during that beautiful moment that we had from 2015 till 19. So it happens, and it can be very stirring for the group too when it happens like that, especially whenever the players, the entire group, feels as though the front office has done something to make you better. Wow, it's an uplifting moment. Of course, that happens during the trade deadline during the course of the season, but it actually, like we're describing right now, can happen in spring training. So it comes down to that moment. And you bring the guy out and you're having a nice camp, or the camp just begins and you're pretty good to begin with. But all of a sudden, here comes this piece. And I'm telling you, it's exhilarating, and it could definitely stir it up in a positive way for the group.
Well said. And as I said, I remember being there, and that was one of Theo's proudest accomplishments, because Dexter looked like he was signed, sealed, and delivered to Baltimore. And no one in this day and age, it's shocking. No one had any clue that that deal was going down. And when Dexter showed up, even the players were surprised. So Theo somehow was able to keep that one under wraps. And I do remember how much he meant to your club, Joe, and that boost your team got, because he completed your team, especially at the leadoff spot. So we'll see where Cody Bellinger winds up. In the meantime, this has been fun, Joe, talking about football, baseball, and when to commit and who to commit to in time. So you've always been great. I'm counting on you again to take us out with some words of wisdom to finish up this latest edition of the Book of Joe.
Well, I was in the football frame of mind. I watched pretty much both games in their entireties. And Dan Campbell, I've been locked in him, man. I don't know the man. I'd love to meet him. I think he's exactly who we think he is by watching him and listening to him. And I think that's wonderful. Authenticity always plays. Sincerity always plays. Accountability always plays. And I think that's who he is. So I was looking for something along those lines. He was criticized for going for the touchdown as opposed to the field. I mean, going for the first down. From Arthur Ashe, you've got to get to the stage in life where going for it is more important than winning or losing. And I think I've always thought, in order to win, you can't be afraid to lose. That's what was exemplified by his thought process. And again, I've talked about it being analytically protected, but nevertheless, that's who he is. I don't even know to what extent it is analytically protected. It just might be exactly how he thinks. But it's more important than winning or losing, and that's going for it. Whatever you believe in, you got to go for it in your stage in life. Last point, playoff series against the Red Sox, 2008 at Tropicana Field. J.D. Drew was going to the right field corner, pop up, Fernando Perez on the third base, tagging up. So we thought that Drew was going to let the ball drop, but he did not. It was relatively shallow, but Fernando could fly. So Fernando tags up. He comes across. He scores. Rays win. And afterwards, Fernando blurted out the phrase, "We err on the side of aggressiveness." God, did I love that. I wanted to kiss him on the lips when he said that. That is the attitude you have to be a champion. You cannot be tentative. You can't be mealy. You can't be wishy-washy, however you want to describe it. Dan Campbell is not any of that. And Fernando is one of the brightest players I've ever had in the big leagues. Columbia University said, "We err on the side of aggressiveness," and I love it till this day.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love that line too, and especially coming from one of the most literate players you'll ever come across in the big leagues, Fernando.
That's right.
A gem.
That's right.
It's been fun, Joe. Thanks. We'll see you next time. Great job.
Thank you, brother. You too.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Zero Foxtrot isn't just a brand. It's a way of life. Founded and operated by veterans, Zero Foxtrot's unique apparel and gear echoes the grit of the warrior culture. Zero Foxtrot dedicates itself to producing content, honoring the sacrifices of forgotten heroes of the past, and connecting history to the present. Embark on a journey with Zero Foxtrot today at ZeroFoxtrot.com. It's not merely our products. It's about the ethos that we embody. Rugged, resilient, and timeless.